I want to start this show with a number. $56,500 in dollars. That was the median household income in America last year. And I am Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. That number is about the most real-life one you can get. And it's so important because it finally budged. For years, we've been talking about stagnant middle-class incomes in almost everything that's been written or said about the middle class or the U.S. economy. And this past year, those incomes grew more than 5%. Now we get to learn what it means when families try to do all the normal things they do. Whether you're like one of the people you'll meet later who enjoys paying with $2 bills, or one of our listeners who shared their stories about how to afford college. As always, come share your thoughts with us at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. We are starting off the show with our own take on the news, a segment we call Long and Short. That's when we ask some smart people to bet on or against topics and trends in the news. And this week, to go long and short, we have Lindsay Turrentine, editor-in-chief of CNET.com, and Marketplace's own Andy Euler. Welcome to you both.
Hey, Lizzie.
Hi, Lizzie.
Well, it's good to have you guys here. I'm going to let you go first, Andy. Tell me about your long.
I'm long on institutions and organizations taking a stand on what they think is right. And I'm kind of talking about the NDA, the NCAA, and now the ACC coming out and saying, look, we're going to move from North Carolina because we don't think the laws are, we think they're discriminatory. And so
we're talking about their gender bathroom laws.
Exactly. HB2, I think, is the law that we're talking about. And again, I'm more long on kind of the sentiment and the idea that it sets sort of a precedent for organizations coming out and saying, look, if we don't think what your laws say are right, we're gonna leave. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's kind of great.
I have to vehemently agree with you.
Okay.
And I think that it's kind of like an enforced boycott.
Right.
Those organizations know how important these events are, these sports events are to North Carolina. It is important to that state.
Oh, massive economically. Right.
And it is going to force people to pay attention to this issue. Like, there may be a lot of people around North Carolina who are sort of like, I don't know, that's not my problem.
Sure.
That doesn't affect me personally. And all of a sudden, it does.
Okay, so I'm going to be the cynic, sure, and the water thrower here. Do you guys really not think this is also in part about the audience that we're talking about? We're talking about younger people, a more diverse audience, advertisers who want to cater to those people and watch sporting events on TV. I think there is, shall we say, a corporate upside to this as well.
I think the advertising point is a huge one.
Sure.
I doubt that's the reason why they're doing this,
right,
but it certainly doesn't hurt their relationship with advertisers. I think that sports are sort of sacred no matter what, and I think that most sports fans will watch sports. It doesn't matter how poor their political decisions are. They will still stand by their team. Advertisers, a lot more fickle.
True. All right, Lindsay, let's move on to your long, because I don't know. I'm a little skeptical, but go for it.
So Bluetooth listening to music or phone calls or taking your phone calls on non-wired headphones. Everybody's talking about Apple AirPods,
yeah,
and how fantastically dorky they look. And they do. But we're moving in this direction where low-powered Bluetooth is going to become ubiquitous. It's going to get easier and easier to listen to music for long periods of time on wireless headphones. And wireless headphones are liberating. Earbuds that are not attached to anything, I think, is going to become more and more appealing as these products get better, and AirPods are just forcing the issue.
So if you're long this, you think that customers are going to fully adopt just being wireless?
I think they will. I think it's going to take a while, and AirPods are not going to do it. They cost $160, and people are just going to be like, well, no, some wired earphones come with the phone. I'm not
right.
going to go out and buy that.
Right.
But a few loyalists will. They'll get really excited about it. It'll help Apple solve some problems that Apple owns Beats, and it'll help them solve problems with Beats wireless headphones, and then lots of competitors will come out, and the competitors will be cheaper. We're already seeing competitors that cost a fraction of what the Apple version does. And over time, they're just going to start using them, and it'll creep up on us. It'll take a few years.
Are we going to stop looking like idiots, though?
No. It's going to become the new normal. We just won't realize we look like idiots.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, speaking of idiots, Andy.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell me about your short, because I've never not been an idiot when trying to deal with this particular company.
All right. I'm short on IKEA. And I went to IKEA a couple of weeks ago. My parents were in town. And of course I went with my parents because that's what you do. I'm not in college anymore, but I still went with my parents. I always call it the place where healthy relationships go to die because it's just so frustrating, isn't it? I mean, now we
I love it. I love it.
Really?
I love IKEA and everything about it.
Okay,
I think
but
forever.
Why now? Why now they've come out with all these big high-profile, you know, collaborations.
I don't think that's the IKEA move, right? I mean, you go there because you want to spend $100 on a coffee table. You don't go there. And maybe you're still going to spend $100 on a coffee table and it's going to look super cool. I just don't go to IKEA because I want to look really fashionable or I want to impress people at a party, right? I mean,
so you don't care about these new designer collaborations?
I kind of don't. Yeah.
I do.
You do? Okay.
I mean, okay, so here's the thing with IKEA.
Sure.
Like, it's a wonderland. You can go in there and you can find something that nobody else is going to have because there's just so much stuff there. Or you're going to find some little gem that you wouldn't have thought you needed and then it ends up in your house.
But you totally don't need it.
But
you totally don't need it.
What is need? What is need?
Well, see, that's the thing, though, is that IKEA does these, they do tons of surveys. They survey tens of thousands of people and ask them what they need. And then you go into IKEA and none of the stuff that you buy you actually need. That's why
I am so long on IKEA, because they get you to do that. It's like the Target effect times 20.
Is it also the most American non-American company of all time? I mean, they're Swedish, but at the same time, like I'm saying, you go there and you it's just buying things for the sake of buying things, right?
I am short any marriage that enters the doors of an IKEA. All right, Lindsay, you get to take us out with your short.
My short is hashtag no makeup. Now, Alicia Keys, this has been going on really at some level for months. Alicia Keys in May kind of came out with a statement that she just thinks it's oppressive that women, especially in Hollywood or all over the place, feel like they have to wear makeup to exist in society. Mm-hmm. And I think that is awesome. And I am so glad she's saying it. And I think that Alicia Keys looks amazing without makeup on, and she is beautiful. And I wish I were Alicia Keys. However, I don't think it's going to work. I think it might help a few people feel like they don't have to put pancake makeup on their face in order to exist in society. But I think that the makeup industry is not suffering, and it is never going to suffer. And people will pay or do almost anything to look more attractive than they think they are.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. I mean, Goldman Sachs values the beauty industry at $24 billion.
Jeez.
That is a ginormous industry, and it is nothing if not nimble. You know, they can look at Alicia Keys and then say, here are 18 products to get yourself the no makeup look.
I think you're spot on, and it's just going to be a matter of time until we've got the Alicia Keys line.
Lindsay Turrentine from CNET, Andy Euler from Marketplace, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun.
Now to the UK, where the British government has given the go-ahead for the first new nuclear power plant in 20 years. The reactor at Hinkley Point will cost around $24 billion. A French company will build it, with China putting up a big chunk of the money, and people are divided. Supporters want the low-carbon electricity, but critics complain about the cost and say China's involvement is a security threat. From London, our Stephen Beard reports.
Amid all the trappings of a state visit, including a ride to Buckingham Palace in a gilded carriage, the Chinese president signed the nuclear deal with the UK last year. Prime Minister Cameron hailed a new golden era for Anglo-Sino relations. But then Cameron fell from office after the vote for Brexit, and the new government put the deal on hold. This week in Parliament, Business Secretary Greg Clark finally, triumphantly gave the deal the green light.
Hinkley unleashes a long overdue new wave of investment in nuclear engineering in the UK, providing a huge boost to the economy.
Mechanical diggers have been preparing the Hinkley site for months. Vincent de Rivard, boss of the French company that's building the plant, is relieved it's going ahead. And he says so should Britain be. The project will create 25,000 construction jobs, supply 7% of the UK's electricity demand, and reduce UK dependence on fossil fuels.
It's great news for the customers. It's a big boost for the UK industry. It's a great step in the fight against climate change.
Others say the deal sends an important signal to the world following the Brexit vote that Britain is open for business. But not everyone is celebrating.
This is a bad deal. We shouldn't go ahead with it.
Isabel Hilton of the China Dialogue website. She says Hinkley will saddle consumers with overpriced power. More worryingly, she says, the deal allows the Chinese to go on and build and run their own nuclear reactor on another site on British soil.
I don't think you want to put that in the hands of a government that is in no sense a strategic ally. You know, China's strategic interests are not Britain's strategic interests.
Other critics warn the Chinese could use this foothold in Britain's national grid to sabotage UK electricity supply. Dr. Mike Bluck, head of the Centre for Nuclear Engineering at Imperial College London, finds that fanciful.
Since this is really a technology showcase for them, to tarnish that in any way, this would be the worst thing that they could possibly do.
But politics trumps economics. If push comes to shove in the South China Sea and there's a standoff between the US and China, Isabel Hilton fears that Britain's loyalties could be sorely tested.
Allowing the Chinese to operate parts of our critical infrastructure gives them an enormous pressure point.
Brexit, she admits, has forced Britain to scan the horizon looking for new trading partners, but not at any cost.
You have to think of the costs in other respects, like our relationships with our existing close strategic partners, the United States in particular.
This week, the British government said it'll take a special share in any future nuclear projects to protect national security. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Now to that number I talked about before. If there is one thing that's embodied that economy meets real life phrase over the past few years, it's middle class incomes. They have stagnated for years, and Americans have really felt it. Except for this week, when we got that news from the Census Bureau that incomes have grown a lot. Median household income grew 5.2% last year to $56,500. That's the biggest jump since they started keeping records in 1967. So, okay, that's the macroeconomics. We brought in Marketplace's Kimberly Adams for the real-life part of the story. If you are listening to this, what do those numbers mean for you?
It kind of depends on who you are and where you are. Overall, everybody's incomes went up. Now, wages, if we look at wages and income, because those are two different things, wages did go up a little bit by, like, you know, around 2%. And incomes also went up. Now, why did we see incomes going up by about 5% across the board, but wages only going up a little bit? Well, because people get their income from places other than direct wages. So maybe you may only be making minimum wage at a job, but you're working longer hours, so you have a higher income. Or maybe your wages only went up a little bit, but you supplemented that with investments or with taking on another job or driving an Uber or Lyft or something like that. So according to these numbers, which are from 2015, people are already getting more income somehow. So you may have already seen a little bit of an increase in your wages or a little bit of an increase in the money coming in. And some of that income is going up because you're spending less on other things.
Does any of this make up for what have been some pretty rough and stagnant years?
Almost, Lizzie, almost. It seems that these numbers are showing that we are very, very close to sort of balancing out to get back to where we were before the recession. One of the economists whom I spoke was saying that these numbers kind of give us a snapshot when you ask the question, how long does it take us to recover from a disastrous recession like the one we had? Well, since we're almost back, it's going to take about a decade to recover. And so people may not feel these gains, which are across the board. You know, if you look at the numbers, they're good numbers. But people may not feel it so much because it really just feels like they're finally catching up as opposed to doing better.
One of the remarkable things about these gains is that they are so broad-based across racial groups, across gender, across lots of different communities. What about rural incomes?
You still saw some increases in incomes. You still saw a decrease in the poverty rate. But I was talking to Elizabeth Babcock. She's the president and CEO of a Boston-based group called Empath, which works with low-income families. And here's how she explained this to me.
Rural areas are not improving as fast in their poverty rates as urban areas are. In rural areas, this is largely due to the lack of ability of individuals to get into family-sustaining jobs and the difficulty of being connected to family-sustaining jobs. And in urban areas where there is more opportunity to work, low-income families are getting gains in their earnings primarily through working more hours as opposed to having increases in their pay.
So we've talked a lot on your program, on all the Marketplace programs, about how people have been moving to the cities in really high numbers and how cities have been really coming back as the center of the economy in the United States. And what that means is that people are moving into cities for reasons, because the jobs are there, which means the jobs aren't so much in rural areas anymore, which means that people in rural areas are struggling to take advantage of the tightening labor market because it's not tightening for them.
You mentioned that wages have gone up, and at the same time, purchasing power is in a decent place because inflation's pretty low and oil prices have been extremely low. But if I look forward, is any of this stuff going to be potentially threatened by rising prices?
So something like oil, we aren't going to see an increase in oil prices just because the labor market is getting better in the United States. Oil prices tend to be set due to global market conditions, and it looks like oil is going to stay pretty cheap for a while. So we probably will get a chance to keep that money in our pockets. But if you look at the cost of something like healthcare, for example, those costs are going up and those do depend on demand. And the same with housing, which the prices go up as more people want them and as people's incomes grow and not just their wages, those prices will probably keep going up. The census report that just came out also gave us new information on healthcare. More people have access to healthcare, which is clearly linked to Obamacare, and there aren't necessarily enough doctors and nurses to keep up with the demand, and so prices may continue to go up in that area.
Marketplace's Kimberly Adams, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Over the past few weeks, we've been sharing your stories about education and money. No surprise, the biggest thing that keeps coming up, paying for college, which is particularly important when we think about those family incomes, because that's where a lot of income goes. Greg LeCheminot is 58. He lives in Santa Rosa, California, and he and his wife have six kids. From the start, they knew that they wouldn't be able to pay for their children's college education. So they told their kids that paying for school would have to be on them.
You know, certainly you're not going to cover it all by high school jobs. They all also took on a part-time job while they're in college. And then I think it goes without saying that another message that was pretty important for them to have was that, you know, you're not going to Harvard. We just can't afford it.
Did they ever get mad at you when you said, you know, no, you're not going to the school with the highest price tag?
Honestly, I don't think so. I mean, I've had discussions with the older ones, just see, you know, how did it go? And I think they're all actually appreciative of the fact that they were able to do as much as they could on their own. You know, one of the things I is important to bring up is we didn't just cut them loose. We did say, you do all you can, and if you need some help, let us know.
You know, I've been doing a lot of reporting on student debt, and so many families, they just can't make up the total without taking out some loans. So what would you say to a parent who's listening to this, you know, wants to know how you guys managed to pull this off?
Well, we're assuming it can be done without student loans. I think if you go in with that assumption up front, there's a likelihood that the student debt would not be as big as it would be if you went into it thinking it's a given that I'm going to take on debt.
Well, Greg LeCheminot, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
We also heard from listener Mark Paz. He's 60, lives in Nashville, and he and his wife were actually able to save a lot of money for their kids' education.
Well, my father was an immigrant, and I was the first one from our family in this country to go to college. And so when I got married, we knew that it was important for our kids to go to college. And so my wife and I decided we would start putting away $50 a month the day my son was born. And then any gifts that we got, we added them to that fund. And when my daughter was born 6 years later, we started the same for her, $50 a month, every month just on auto deposit. And then when we started making a little bit more money, we upped it to $100 a month each. And when we could, we'd put in a little bit more. And sure enough, by the time my son turned 18 and was thinking of going to college, we turned around and we had about $60,000 saved up for his college.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
So I sat down with him and said, you know, here's what we did, explained to him how we had had this savings plan and that he had $60,000 to pay for his college education. And then he said, well, what if there's money left over? And I said, well, the good news is if there's money left over, it's all yours. He said, well, you know, he wanted to save as much of that money as he could. So he became a little bit spendthrift while at college, working and saving money. And then when my daughter got old enough to go to college, the first thing she did was get a part-time job also. So they both kind of were responsible for their funds. And when they both graduated, they had some money left over, and they used it for whatever they wanted to use it for.
With your kids now, do you think they've carried this lesson about kind of financial transparency and working toward goals into their adult lives?
Well, I think both of them have. One is that they're very motivated. You know, they're both getting married, and they tend to be the ones that are more fiscally responsible than their significant others or their spouse. I think it was a good lesson.
Mark Paz, thank you very much for talking to us.
Well, thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Adriana Trevino is 42 and lives in San Antonio. She just finished getting her associate's degree and was aiming for nursing school. But she's also got two sons, and she and her husband decided that saving for their boys' education was more important than getting her nursing degree.
I'm putting my dreams of becoming a nurse to the side. It's kind of me or my family, and I'm having to choose them.
You said you described your family as lower middle class, and I guess I wonder, when you're thinking about your boys, do you think that to be in the middle class, you need to have a college degree these days?
You know, I've realized in order for you to be successful financially, and I'm not talking about millionaire or billionaire, you do need a college degree. A lot of employers look at that as it's a sign that says that you're willing to commit, that they know that they can count on you to do it. So I know that without a degree, that you're going to be facing some major obstacles.
Do you ever see a moment where you might be able to go to nursing school?
I'm trying not to think about it too much, because if I think about it, it hurts. It really does. But what I am determined to do and what I am praying for is that wherever I find that full-time job with whatever company I find it with, that maybe I can get a bachelor's degree and they'll be able to help me pay for it. And, you know, at this point, Lizzie, I don't care if it's business, administration, I'll do it. It doesn't have to necessarily be nursing. Maybe I'm meant to work with people in a different way. Maybe nursing school was just to help me show my kids, this is what you will have to deal with if you do not get a degree before you settle down and get a family. Maybe that's what it was supposed to be. So I really don't know.
Adriana Trevino, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
We're going to spend a lot more time talking about the cost of college and about the 42 million people in America with student debt very soon as part of an upcoming collaboration with the PBS NewsHour. But in the meantime, we brought in Marketplace's education correspondent, Amy Scott, to put your stories in context. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Lizzie.
We heard from those callers kind of different ways where they are anxious, nervous, figuring out how to pay for education, specifically the high cost of college. And I guess I'm wondering,
since you cover education, how has the awareness of the amount of debt that we are in as Americans, $1.3 trillion in debt to pay for college, how has that changed the conversation about college and college affordability?
Well, I think it definitely has changed the conversation, not only because of debt levels, but because of just the rising cost of tuition. And it does seem like we're at a turning point where more people are questioning the value of college and talking about alternatives like vocational education and apprenticeships. Those are getting more attention even in the presidential campaign.
Yeah.
And there was just this interesting survey from a research group called Public Agenda. For years, they've been asking this question, do you think that a college education is necessary for a person to be successful in today's work world? And for years, the answer was increasingly yes. But that yes answer has been actually declining since the Great Recession. And this year, just 42% of Americans said that college is necessary for workforce success, which is down about 13 percentage points from 2009. So that shift, I think, is a sign that people are less convinced that college is worth the debt and the expense.
Okay, so if we're going to shift this from sort of the macro to the personal a little bit, so let's say you are someone who can afford to save some money, even if it's a little bit, for your kids to go to school. How early do you start? And I think one interesting philosophical wrinkle in that is, do you include your kids in the conversation? You know, how transparent an effort is this for a family?
Okay, well, I'm just going to come clean here and say that I am far from an expert. So do as I say, not as I do, because I have not started saving for my kids' college. But people say that you should start as early as you can, like at birth. But it's interesting because Sallie Mae, the private student loan company, does this survey of how families are saving for college, and less than half are saving. So I'm definitely not alone. As for whether to include your kids in the conversation, I think at some point, definitely. I've heard in my reporting from families that have to choose between, you know, feeding their kids or saving for college, paying for their own retirement or saving for their kids' college. So it's not always, I think, a clear answer.
You have also done a fair amount of reporting on kids who are the first in their generation to go to college. It's a really wonderful series that you did, First in the Family. And
thank you.
I was wondering how they view the question of college affordability and that sort of is college worth it question. Because after all, these are the people who have been given that message, go to school and you will be in the American middle class.
Right. Generally, I'm finding that they think college was worth it, or those who are still in school think it is worth it. Earnings are higher, unemployment rates are much lower if you have a college degree. Then again, if you don't get the degree, that equation changes quite a bit. Almost half of people who start college don't finish 6 years later. We're talking about more than 30 million people who are in that position who have some college but haven't finished. So if you're carrying debt but you don't have the degree, you can actually end up worse off than if you hadn't gone at all.
I want to shift from college, maybe down to more your home turf right now, K through 12. It feels anecdotally like parents have had to spend a lot more on K through 12 education. What kind of trends are we seeing prior to higher education?
Yeah, it feels like that to me, too, having just gone through my first back to school shopping trip. According to the National Retail Federation, which, you know, represents companies that profit from this back-to-school spending, families were planning to spend an average of $673 this year on K-12. That's about $40 more than last year, and it's up 55% over the past 10 years. And that's just new clothes and shoes and school supplies. You know, there's also tutoring and after-school enrichment programs and language classes. A few years ago, MIT economics professor Michael Greenstone estimated that high-income families spend as much as $9,000 a year on private tutors, SAT prep, and other activities, while a low-income family might spend around $1,300. So for families that have means, spending is definitely going up.
Marketplace's education correspondent, Amy Scott. Thank you.
Anytime.
For next week's conversation, what have you always wanted to understand better about money, but were afraid to ask? Let us know. We're here to explain. Visit marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, just search for Marketplace Business News, or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. Over Labor Day weekend, Chicago hit an ugly milestone, 500 murders this year. That's more than New York and LA combined. We want to talk about the violence now, but not just guns and gangs, to really look at the economic links between poverty, segregation, and violence. So we turn to an expert, reporter Natalie Moore, who covers the South Side of Chicago for the public radio station there, WBEZ. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
To put all of this violence in an economic context, I guess I want you first to put it in a geographic context. So we're talking about the South and West Sides of Chicago. What do they look like and feel like?
They're pretty big places, and it's hard to summarize them in one fell swoop. So we tend to think of the South Side as all Black, and there certainly are dozens of Black neighborhoods, but there are also white neighborhoods, Latino neighborhoods, and mixed neighborhoods. The violence that we have seen in Chicago are contained in just a handful of neighborhoods on the South and West Sides. And those neighborhoods tend to have high unemployment and high poverty. In general, the feel of these neighborhoods, you know, there is this impression that it's the Wild West and that there are shootings on corners all the time. You know, it's still summertime, so there's barbecue smoke that you smell from the expressway or in neighborhoods. Kids are going to school, businesses, traffic, vibrancy. You know, there's no one singular story in these Black neighborhoods, but it seems that the singular story coming out is that of violence.
I was reading a piece in the Chicago Tribune recently, and they quoted a pastor in West Garfield Park saying, "If you show me people without hope, I'll show you people that's willing to pick up a gun and do something with it," which I think is something we hear a lot when you talk about disenfranchised neighborhoods, neighborhoods with high rates of violence. I want to get your sense of how kind of economic opportunity and this particular rise in violence are linked in what you've seen and what you've reported on.
I want to take it a step farther than the hopelessness comment, because I think that, of course, these are individuals who are making decisions about picking up a gun. But I think that we fail ourselves in solutions when we just look at this as individual problems and not look at the structural problems in neighborhoods. So I mentioned that we see high poverty and crime linked together, unemployment. But these neighborhoods don't have a lot of businesses. There's disinvestment. And, you know, you can't talk about these issues without talking about economics. So I look at violence as a symptom of lack of economic development.
Well, yeah. And I guess that gets to kind of the bigger question behind, well, OK, when someone proposes a solution or a way they want to tackle the violence, can you do that without, say, looking at housing segregation, without looking at the number of schools that are under-enrolled in, you know, some parts of the South Side of Chicago? When you talk to both people in government and people in the community, what kinds of solutions do you hear?
Not very good ones, quite frankly.
Wow.
I'm just going to be honest. This is not a policing issue. And I think a lot of elected officials say we need more police on the streets. So if you go into neighborhoods, people are not clamoring for police. The police do not prevent violence, and they are not a catalyst for social change or for economic change. So it's often looked at, well, why is New York less violent than Chicago? Why is LA less violent? One, Chicago has always been more violent than those cities, going back to the days of Prohibition. But Chicago is also more segregated than those neighborhoods. And segregation isn't about Black people needing to live next to white people. It's about resources and proximity to resources and inequity. And decades of bad housing policies that have created black ghettos are not going to be reversed overnight, it's less sexy to talk about housing segregation and unequal resources when you're talking about gun violence. Those are structural issues and neighborhood issues and policy-driven issues that will go a long way in decreasing violence.
So what's standing in the way from Rahm Emanuel or someone else in Chicago in power from saying, okay, let's talk about that stuff?
So I ask myself these questions. I struggle with these questions myself. And I see a lack of political will. I see politicians saying, well, it's not my job to take on segregation. This is what defines Chicago. And the drumbeat that I've been banging is that we can't look at any of these issues without addressing segregation. And segregation is not about self-selection. This is about past and current policies that keep neighborhoods under-resourced and underserved.
You also, you live in the South Side, you live in Bronzeville. This is not just your beat, but I mean, this kind of these questions are things you go to bed with and wake up with in the morning. And, you know, do you think when you think about this in the middle of the night, do you think this can be fixed?
You know, I probably thought that it couldn't be, but, you know, I think I've done so much reading and talked to so many smart people that there's no one solution that can fix everything. There's no magic wand, and I don't even know if things can be fixed in a generation.
What else haven't I asked you that you think our listeners need to know when they see a headline, you know, about horrible shooting in Chicago and they don't know how to make sense of it? What do they need to know to make sense of it?
You know, Chicago has become the face of urban violence, and we see other places struggle with gun violence, whether it's white suburbia with school shooting or other urban locales like Philadelphia, Baltimore. I think that Chicago is not just about violence. Black neighborhoods are not just about violence. You know, it's crime does happen. I don't want to be insensitive either because people are losing their lives and it is a problem. But until we talk about it in honest ways, people are either going to just write it off as those crazy black and brown people who don't have self-control, or you hear things like black people don't care about black-on-black crime when I see block club presidents, community activists, grandmothers. Like, there are all kinds of people who are trying to make their blocks and their communities better. And I think to help these places, we have to broaden the conversation and the scope to go beyond violence. I think people have to understand that there is an economic cost to violence and a lack of economics that plagues these places.
Natalie Moore, WBEZ's Southside reporter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
If you looked inside your wallet right now, you've probably got, what, a couple of dollar bills, maybe a few fives or a 20. But when was the last time you had a $2 bill? Mine was tucked inside a card from my grandmother. Other than that, I don't really use them. But there is a particular group of people who stash $2 bills away, accumulate them, or have a special fascination with the currency. John Bernardo is now one of them. And he made the aptly named movie, The $2 Bill Documentary, which he's been showing in film festivals. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Why make a documentary about the $2 bill?
You know, I get asked that question so many times. And my answer is usually that, like many people, I have $2 bills that I received as a child or growing up, and I always save them like so many people do. And I have 11 of them in a desk drawer. And I pull them out every once in a while and look at them and wonder about them and want to do something with them. I certainly don't want to spend them because then I won't have them anymore. And I am a production person. I've made a few documentary shorts, and it just seemed to add up one day that, you know, I want to know more about these and I'm looking for a project. Why don't I make a documentary about the $2 bill? And so it started from there, and I discovered so many wonderful things about it that it really warranted a 90-minute movie.
Yeah, I have to say, I was surprised. I was like, really? 90 minutes on a piece of currency? But I did not know that they are still made. I thought $2 bills were out of circulation.
Join the club. A lot of people think that.
Well, why do we have that perception, do you think?
Well, the movie addresses it, and it really goes back to 1976 when they reissued the bill for the bicentennial. And it was, as the movie states, it was so beautiful with the back of the bill having the Declaration of Independence painting on there. People thought it was a collector's item. They thought it came out strictly for the bicentennial and wasn't something we should use as currency. And so since 1976, people just believe it is this novelty and is this rare thing that they put out only in 1976, and they save them. And because people save them and don't spend them, you never see them. And because you never see them, you think they're rare, and the cycle repeats.
You know, I have one of those 1976 $2 bills that my grandma Elsie stocked away when I was a baby. And she wrote a little note saying, you know, someday this may be worth a lot of money, but it's just worth $2, right?
Right. It's only worth $2 unless it has a couple of certain features like a unique serial number, or if it could be in pristine condition with perfect edges and corners. And but that's usually not going to happen. So most people believe that they have something of value. And if you look on eBay, you'll find people selling them for $5 or $6, but they are worth just $2.
Tell us about some of the people in this documentary, because you found people who kind of make the $2 bill central to, I guess you could say, even their identity, like Matthew.
Spending Twos has allowed me to have a relationship with people who I do not believe I would have a relationship with otherwise.
How old is he now?
19, 20 months. I interact with many more human beings on a richer level. Even if it's one sentence, even if it's no words but a smile, it's always richer, guaranteed.
Right, great example. Matthew Zaklatt is a perfect example. He's actually one of the first people I found when I was doing my research. There was a blog about him, and I was amazed. I was like, holy cow, there's somebody who actually uses $2 bills. Come to find out, as I made the film, there are a lot of people that use $2 bills. A lot of people find them to be so rewarding. When you spend them, you get a reaction from someone. You get remembered when you tip with them. People smile and they remember you. You know, special orders at restaurants are going to remember yours if you use $2 bills. You know, restaurants, if you tip with $2 bills, they might save you a nice seat or give you extra nice service. So it's really this wonderful thing. And Matt is one of very many people who use them all the time. And I tell people, I started using them once I started learning about them. When you do use it, something happens. There's an exchange there. You know, a human interaction that you don't get very often anymore with social media and texting and everything. And that face-to-face that happens when you use a $2 bill, that's really what the movie came to be about, was about the connectivity that the $2 bill brings. I think more people should use it, because when you use a 5 or a 10, you don't get that.
Do you think it matters that they're not something we think of as part of our everyday currency?
Great question. You know, I always would love to see more people use them. However, I think if more people use them, it would take away from this magic appeal that they have. So I'm kind of torn between getting it out there so that everybody can use it and also keeping it to be the sacred little secret that I have, that me and several others know about this great bill and can use it. So I don't think it's ever going to catch on, so I think it doesn't really matter what I think, but I would like more people to know about it. It does light up people's faces when they see one. So why not, you know, have more people using it and learning about it more because of the reaction that it gets when it's spent?
You financed this film through Kickstarter.
Correct.
What kind of a reaction did you get when you put the campaign online?
Same kind of reaction I got from people all over when they learned about the film. I thought the movie was originally going to be some hidden camera footage going into a supermarket or whatever and a little bit of history, and I'm lucky if I got to 30 minutes. But as soon as people learned about the film, they came out of the woodwork sharing stories about how they used them in addition to giving a donation for the film. So many people learned about it. I ended up getting a short write-up in a New York Times article about $2 bills, and when people read that, they contacted me. In fact, a good number of people that are in the film are in the film because they found me, not the other way around. There is this great subculture of people that love the bill, and they just jumped at the chance to see it. And people thank me for making it because they love the $2 bill. It's just been an amazing experience to see the reaction from people, both on Kickstarter and anywhere else I've discussed the film.
John Bernardo, director and producer of the $2 bill documentary, thanks so much.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm.
Netflix's show, Stranger Things, is one of the biggest hits of the season. The 80s sci-fi homage has also got a pretty killer soundtrack, with hits from Foreigner, The Bangles, and The Clash. But the show's original music has made a lot of fans, too. It was composed by Survive, a band from Austin, Texas. Its members Kyle Dixon and Michael Stein joined Marketplace tech host Ben Johnson this week. Here's Ben.
Tell me about composing the theme. What did you guys do?
Well,
lit some candles.
You can't play a synthesizer without a candle lit. It started from a pretty rough demo that was kind of, you know, the main sequence and some chords. And that was pretty much it. And they were like, what if this was the theme? Like, and so we basically took that and hooked it up to just about every synth in the studio.
How many is that?
I think that track has about 40 different instruments on it.
Is there a particular moment that comes from a particular synth that you guys were super psyched? Were you like, oh yeah, the Bleep Labs thing, or I don't know, the Moog, whatever, the Rogue Moog, or I don't
Labs.
Know, you know?
Nice.
What's up, John Mike?
We didn't use any Bleep Labs, unfortunately, and I can't say that. We did use a lot of the Prophet 6, a new analog, kind of an update on the Prophet 5, which was a very popular synth in the early 80s, used by bands like Yellow Magic Orchestra, John Carpenter, a studio piece that many people had.
Is there a scene or an episode that you felt like you really nailed it?
Well, it was one of the scenes that took a very long time to get right, to get everyone on board with, is the very first cue, which is called Kids. It's the first time you hear any music in the show, and because of that, they had us try many, many different things for that. I'm pretty happy with the way that turned out.
What about you, Michael?
I guess it'd be maybe one of the moments where you do more live score to picture and just really see it click. Like the Nancy and Steve kiss. The mood's kind of... it's not happy and it's not sad, but it's this weird middle mood, and then it's got this embellished kiss part.
Kyle Dixon and Michael Stein are from the Austin band Survive and soundtracked the show Stranger Things. Kyle, Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, we'll meet one of Reddit's new employees, a cultural anthropologist. And we'll find out what you've always wanted to understand about money. Is there something that you want to know? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chatting with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, just search for Marketplace Business News, or you can call us, 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman, Eliza Mills, and Adriana Cargill. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.